Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 180 featuring Ken Ibrahim, and I have known Ken for many, many years, and you will know that based on our podcast. But he's a good friend of mine, and he's a very, very talented person. He's worked at numerous places, including Tippett and PDI and Square and Digital Domain, et cetera, et cetera. And he also worked at J.J. Abrams' studio, which is incredible and one of his lifelong dreams. So that was really cool to see that or hear about that. And he's just a very entertaining and very informative guy. I was really enjoyed talking to him. He came here for his 50th birthday and flew directly, came directly from the airport to the studio so we could record this podcast, which is very kind of him. I've wanted to do a podcast with him for quite a while, and I always, as you know, want to do them in person. So he and I sat down like we used to do back at Digital Domain, have a little bit of Scotch whiskey, and although it wasn't Scotch, it was a Japanese whiskey, and it was really good, and enjoyed ourselves. So a lot of fun with Ken, and I really appreciate him coming by. I want to note a couple of things about that, the episode. At the end of the episode, we end up talking about podcasting in general, and we talk about the Nerdist podcast and about Chris Hardwick himself. And this was recorded before some of the news came out about Chris Hardwick. So if you're wondering why we're not talking about that, that was because it was recorded before that news came out. And I didn't feel like I wanted to take it out because or edit out any of the audio, because I don't think that's right to do that. And also I think that what we said is still very relevant in terms of the quality of the Nerdist podcast and some of the things that that Chris Hardwick has been doing. What's going on in his personal life, honestly, I don't know, and it's none of my business, and I don't think it should be anyone's business what's going on in that area. But the Nerdist podcast is a big influence on how I run this podcast, so I thought it was relevant to keep it in there and to discuss it in general. So, but if you guys think that's, I'd love to hear your opinions if you think it's different. Nonetheless, let's see, what other announcements do we have here? We have, if you guys are Maya users, you should be downloading the latest V-Ray Next for Maya beta and giving it a try, and let us know what's going on. So go to chaosgroup.com and check that out. We would love to know more about it. And it's very important that you get feedback from this, because that's what makes the product better. And if you are a 3ds Max user, then you can go ahead and purchase or upgrade or the new V-Ray Next there. And again, it's pretty robust. It's been in really good shape. So let us know what you think as well. We would love to hear from that. Lastly, if you're going to go to SIGGRAPH, which is happening in Vancouver sort of in mid-August, we would love to see you there. We are still prepping and finalizing our V-Ray Days events, which is promising to be really big. Lots of amazing people are going to be attending. Melissa has done an amazing job of recruiting some incredible speakers to come and talk about their great work. So I'm very excited about that. I will be there. I would love to hear from you as well. So that's what's going on. Besides V-Ray Days, there's going to be some really big announcements that I have to keep under wraps until then, happening at SIGGRAPH. So be on the lookout and listen to some of the big announcements that are happening, besides releases, just some incredible R&D that's going on as well. Very excited about this work happening this year. We've had a really amazing 2018 in terms of developing and creating new things. So really, really exciting. All right, guys, that's all I have. Hopefully you guys will enjoy this awesome episode with Ken Ibrahim.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
the whiskey, a nice Japanese whiskey that I've never heard of before.
What is it called?
But it's called in Japanese, ryo, which is ryo.
Okay.
In English, I guess pronounced Rio, like our old friend from Didi.
Is it really? I mean, is it the same name?
Yeah, that's how it's written.
That's his name too?
Yeah, ryo, but he wouldn't want to be called that by people unless they were actual Japanese. He wanted to be known by Ryo. She danced in the sand. Cheers.
Cheers, yes. A little Duran Duran.
Yeah, I heard that on the radio the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, hold on.
Wow, that's not bad.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It is economical and tasty.
Okay, so Mr. Ibrahim.
Mr. Nichols.
Have you ever seen the movie Mr. Ibrahim?
No.
Really?
Is there one? Yes.
It's a French movie.
That's probably why
Monsieur
I haven't seen
Mr. Ibrahim.
Ibrahim.
And it's starring Omar Sharif.
Okay.
Who plays Mr. Ibrahim.
Well, he's a good actor.
He is a very good actor, and he is a Turkish.
Was a good actor.
And he only acted to fund his passion for playing cards.
I did not know that.
He was an expert bridge player.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've never heard that one, but.
Yeah, and he played this guy who lived in Paris, and sort of takes this young boy under his wings and teaches him, you know, growing up, et cetera, and then they end up going back to Turkey where he is from.
Okay.
It was interesting. It's a good film, actually.
All right. I'll have to look it up.
Check it out.
I don't suppose it's on Netflix.
I don't know where. Yeah.
Maybe Amazon Prime Video.
Maybe Amazon. Do they do many foreign films?
I'm not sure. Netflix does have a whole section of foreign films.
Really?
So perhaps.
I'll have to look it up.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a good film. So your name is Ibrahim as well.
Yeah, well, my last name.
Yeah.
Are we recording already?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I hear a lot of people ask that question.
Yeah.
Okay, I just got to start this off by saying I'm a fan of the show. I listen to the podcast quite often.
Okay.
I've actually come up with some suggestions for
you
for
have.
People, and hopefully we can hear their stories at some point.
Yeah.
But one thing that's kind of funny is no matter what podcast, I listen to a number of different podcasts.
Uh-huh.
Always listen to them on 1.5 or sometimes 2x speed.
Really?
Just because, you know, I can get through more of them. Yeah, I can still, I mean, it doesn't alter the pitch.
Do I sound bad at 1.5?
No, but you don't sound bad. It's the same quality of your voice. But what I do have to say is your laugh's already distinctive.
Right, but at 1.5 speed, it must be hilarious.
It's even more distinctive when at 1.5 or 2.
Yeah, it's funny.
Listen to one of them at 1.5 speed and see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, because I do have that ability.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I try to do books sometimes that way, but, you know, sometimes I like to just savor them.
Yeah, it depends. Certain ones I'll play at normal speed, but a lot of things, like ones with Dan Thrawn, for instance, they're so long that I say, okay, but I want to hear it all. So, you know.
Right.
So I'll put it at that kind of speed.
Yeah. So you'll take a 2.5 hour episode and turn it into an hour and 45 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah. When you keep saying, oh, we got to wrap up here, and like 30 minutes later, you say it again.
Yeah, I know.
That's what this stuff will do, I guess.
That's what it'll do. It'll do. All right. So thank you for being a fan of the podcast. And
yeah.
We'll go over some of the ideas for the guests. And as you know, and I've said it on the podcast, I actually like to do most of my mine in person.
Right.
And I do have traveling gear, as you saw. So I do. Doesn't mean that I all have to be in Los Angeles. I do go to places. In fact, the one when I did with Adobe, when you remember that one.
Yeah, yeah.
I just went there for the day and came back.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And you were actually relatively close to where I lived.
Right.
Yeah. Like a 5-minute bike ride.
Really?
Yeah, they do. One thing about having moved to San Francisco.
They have all those birds everywhere, don't they? They have them here now.
Oh, yeah, the scooters.
Yeah.
Yeah, like overnight, there were three different companies that came in with scooters. Bird.
They're everywhere here now.
Something, and the other one's called Lime, and those are the green ones. But
yeah.
Bird and the other one, they're like OEM'd from the same manufacturer.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
But I do the bike sharing, so I had two bicycles stolen there, so I figured I'll never buy another one. And then I signed up with one of the bike share things, and that's going pretty well.
Yeah, you had it for like a day.
No, no.
I had an old bike that you took out of storage or something, and it was immediately stolen.
I had the old one I'd brought up from here when I moved about a year and a half ago. But I bought a brand new one. Think, okay, I'm just going to treat myself to a nice new bike. Got the bike. I had it for about maybe 5 weeks. And then I had it parked out in front of the Metreon Theater. I got MoviePass. So like when I'm between gigs, like every day I would be like probably the nightmare customer of MoviePass because I would be there on a daily basis. Anyway, parked the bike out there, locked it out there. And one day it came back and the seat was stolen. And I thought, oh, Jesus, you know, they just pulled the seat out. So I took it. I just rode it right from there to the shop. And they kept it overnight, put a new seat. They had to do a couple of things to modify. And I also had them cut the handlebars are like a longer type. And they said, if you don't like it, we'll cut them. So I had them cut them. Picked it up. Rode back to the apartment, locked it up, went out to a barbecue. An old colleague, it was actually Todd Dufour.
Todd Dufour.
I was working with him briefly at Atomic Fiction, and he had a barbecue. So I went to that barbecue, came back. The next morning, I went to get the bike to ride down to the ferry. It was just gone completely.
Wow.
So that was it. It was repaired one day, and the following day was stolen.
Wow, that sucks.
Yeah. But the bike shares work out pretty well. And the kind of nice ending to that story...
Yeah.
Believe it or not, this worked out. First time ever, I used the policy on my credit card that I bought the bike on. If you, within like 90 days or 180 days or something, if something is damaged or stolen, they'll refund you if it's purchased on the card. Mm-hmm. So I tested this theory and it actually worked.
Wow.
I could not believe it. Like 3 weeks later, they just refunded the payment, the cost of the bike to my account.
Wow. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of shitty though that happens. Mm. Yeah.
San Francisco, it's rampant up there. I mean, they stole it from the locked garage on the second level in the apartment complex.
Right.
The other thing was, I was wondering, why is there so much glass all around the streets of San Francisco? And I was told, oh, it's because of all the car break-ins. So people just go around, you know, smashing the glass on the cars. You get all this fine glass debris everywhere on the sides of the streets. So I actually had one or two flat tires to begin with when I got the new bike because of all the glass. So I had to upgrade the tires, and then finally it was stolen. So I said, no more.
You know? Wow.
Yeah. Wow. It's a bummer.
Yeah.
But the bike share systems, there are two of them there. Those work out really well. And then all the scooters, if you want to use those for a little change of pace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So well, what led you to San Francisco?
Oh, that was, my girlfriend got a good job opportunity up there.
Uh-huh.
And we had been living in L.A. for quite a while. And a few years ago, she was looking at a company up in San Francisco. And if it had it worked out at that time, we were thinking, we'll just move up there and see what it's like to live in the city.
Mm-hmm.
The city. Mm-hmm. So, and I used to work up there about 20 years ago before I moved to L.A. And so this opportunity worked out. And we said, okay, let's just close the chapter in L.A. and commit to moving up there. She sold her condo. I sold my house. And we moved up there. We've been living in an apartment. Been looking for another place to move into. The apartment's kind of a short-term thing. So you just bought a place up near AT&T Park.
Okay.
First time in my life, like, moving on up to the 14th floor, we got a great view of the AT&T ballpark.
Okay.
We can actually see midfield.
Wow.
From our angle. So you don't see much of the game itself. You see, like, one player running around, like a little guy.
Mm-hmm.
But when they do concerts there, like they did the other night, they set the stage up in midfield.
Right.
So Christina Aguilera and the Steve Miller Band, they were playing for the Genentech event last weekend. So that was kind of fun to see that you can hear it. And, you know, it's kind of like a free concert, but you really need binoculars. Or something. But they got the big flat panel displays, and you can kind of see that. So, you know, so I'm actually down in L.A. on this trip for my 50th birthday.
Yeah.
So I've decided to come back down here and just meet up with a bunch of friends. And I'm hoping you're going to make it if you have time on Saturday.
Yeah, I'll see. I'll have to see how my Saturday goes.
Yeah.
Things are pretty busy. But
okay. Well, I'll you're definitely invited.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
So we're down for that. But I figured, you know what? Made it to – about to make it to 50, finally moving on up. It's like the Jeffersons.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You feel good about it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what are you doing in San Francisco?
Not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot, really?
So since I've been up there, I've done a few contract gigs with Atomic Fiction.
Got it.
Are you familiar with
them? Oh, of course.
Okay. So they're over in Jack London Square in Oakland. So I would ride the bike to the ferry building and ferry over there. So that's the only commute I've really ever had that's been kind of beautiful, taking the ferry from San Francisco to Oakland. So I've done a few different independent contracts. I got in touch with them via Todd and another friend.
Oh, Todd DeFore?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because he's the head of effects there.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He's been up there for – he went to ILM, was there for a while. Then he went to Atomic Fiction. He's been there for a while. And then he brought me in. There's actually another guy named Mark Chu, who I've known. He's an old-time ILM guy. He was at ILM for like 23 or 4 years, okay, and then went over to become head of animation at Atomic Fiction. He brought my name up, and Todd said, oh, yeah, that's cool. Let's get him in here. I know that guy. Mm-hmm. So I went, ended up working, doing some pipeline development for the effects group with Todd, and then I came back to help out the animation group doing tools for Maya. I went for another contractor, them doing the same thing. Since then, Todd's moved up to Montreal. That's where their head office.
That's where their new head office is.
Yeah. I may go back for another contract with them at the beginning of August. They're actually moving from Oakland to San Francisco near the Ferry Building, in which case it would be a nice little bike ride.
Right.
So that's kind of what I've been up to as far as actual work. Otherwise, at home, I've just been trying to look into more opportunities where I could leverage the visual effects background but do something different. Like I used to do a certain amount of web development here and there. Mm-hmm. So one thing that's nice about San Francisco is that, you know, this website group called meetup.com. Mm-hmm. So I've been to a couple of their events in LA for different, you know, user groups and whatnot, interest groups. But in San Francisco, they have so many tech-related ones. So I've been going back to kind of, you know, get a pulse on the vibe of what's the latest thing going on in web development. And there are all these different kind of like variants of JavaScript, for instance, like React and all this, where it's now isomorphic, meaning that they use the same. Okay, it used to be that for web development, you'd have the server and the client side. And client side would be like JavaScript, server would be PHP or maybe Python or mm-hmm. something. Isomorphic means they're using the same programming language on for both.
Okay.
So you can program in Java. Now JavaScript's kind of become the lead in all its variants, like okay. Node.js and React and all this kind of stuff. A lot of companies like Facebook or Google, you know, create these internally and then release them, and they become popular, and a lot of people adopt them.
Interesting.
So it's fun to go to these events, and there's so many. And the interesting thing is that a lot of them are, you know, they have a networking component to them, then they have talks, and most of the talks are often by people who are instrumental in the development of the technology or coding language or whatever it is that they're talking about.
Right.
So it's not like me using Maya. You know, it's like someone on the development team or whoever headed it up originally talking about it. It's like, wow, it's kind of from the horse's mouth kind of thing.
Right.
And the best one is the one that's just, again, down near the Ferry Building. I go with an old colleague of mine from Alias when we were working in Japan together. He's been in San Francisco for a while. Mm-hmm. It's the HTML5 meetup, which is hosted at Google. Google's, I guess, their headquarters in the city.
Okay.
They have a great view. They have this amazing buffet. They have, refrigerators full of beer, but then they have a mixologist, and then they have a wine tasting group that comes in like a
people. So you're going to programming meetups mm-hmm. in San Francisco and getting free food and mixes and
yeah.
drinks.
Exactly. But
this is a pretty good job.
Yeah. It's a great gig. There, I mean, most of them are free, except this one. My friend was telling me, you know, it's $10, but he said it didn't used to be that way. What happened was they had too many no-shows. And then, unfortunately, you know, there's a number of homeless in San Francisco, like there are in Santa Monica, Venice, right. whatever. They would find out about it, so they would end up coming up for the food as well. So I guess Google said, no, we can't. We got to filter this stuff out. So they ended up charging on Eventbrite. But it's such a great deal. And then they do a, you know, then you hear these talks, which are pretty good. Then they take a break. There's dessert. You go back for more talks. And at the end, they have a raffle. And you almost always inevitably, if you do the right tweet, you'll win 2 bottles of wine to take home with you.
Nice.
So, yeah. So, and that's probably the best overall example of that. But they've got things for Python. They have things for augmented reality.
Okay.
They do, they have a meetup I've been to a few times for an animation-related meetup that they do at Adobe.
Okay.
So it's just like, and this friend of mine is telling me, literally, if you wanted to, you could spec out a meetup per night of the week, and you'd have dinner every night if you were good with that kind of a pizza diet for the most part, pizza and beer.
Right. Okay.
But you're getting all these talks. I mean, the food and all that's great, but you get all this information from people who are kind of at the root of it.
Right. You know? So this is your new interest, is a lot of web stuff, huh?
Well, just the technology side, like what's going on back in the world of web, because so many things are happening in the browser now with WebGL and all this kind of stuff that right. didn't used to. I mean, there was VRML in the past.
Oh, I remember.
Playing around with that, and I met what's his name again? Tony something. He's at Unity. He was one of he was either originator of VRML or co-creator
okay.
or something. He's the head of their AR and VR
okay.
division now. So Unity's got an office in the city as well. But yeah, just like getting out there and seeing what's the latest in technology, in coding, and you know how these languages are being used in different disciplines. So obviously we've been using Python for a long time in visual effects, mm-hmm. but it's interesting to see how
I remember when we made that transition. I think you and I were at DD.
Yeah.
We were still using Perl.
Yeah.
For a lot of stuff. Yeah. And Johnny Gibson has an opinion about that, I'm sure.
Oh, but, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. But we were still using Perl for a lot of stuff. And then I remember everyone was like, there's this new thing called Python. It's awesome. And I remember who was talking about it? Who was the big guy who was really, really pushing for it?
What
Python
he was a TD, software or TD. CD?
No, he was a TD on Day After Tomorrow. He's a TD.
Right. I didn't actually work you on were, that show. I was on Peter Pan.
You were on Peter Pan, right? Yeah. But Steve Galley.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was Steve Galley.
Okay, because we worked together out at Square,
right?
And I'm pretty sure we used. I think we used Python to some degree out there, did some C++ Maya plugin stuff.
Right.
But if you want to hear a little story about Python, way back when I was in Japan, this was probably when I was working at Alias Wavefront, which is the last job I had there. They brought an intern in from Canada, a young Chinese, a guy of Chinese descent, mm-hmm. super smart, super nice guy. He won like amateur national math competitions in Canada.
All right.
He introduced me to Python and said, hey, you should learn this. And what he did as an example is he took all of the, I think it was either PowerAnimate or Maya documentation, and he rewrote kind of the front end to that. So whatever search or query you were doing in the browser, it would return nicely formatted pages where each instance of the query would be a hyperlink.
Wow.
And stuff that's like, wow, that's amazing. I mean, it's probably not that big a deal to do it today, but when he was showing me then, he's like, you should really learn this language. This is probably like 95.
Right.
And then I got back to the States, we could talk about all the visual effects background, but when I was at PDI, I was trying to push for Python, and oddly enough, there's a couple of guys in the development group who really liked it and say, hey, you know what? Yeah, let's do that. We're going to start converting some of our libraries. Mm-hmm. To Python APIs. That's great because they were using Perl. I remember when I got to PDI, they actually gave you like a week or two of training, and a lot of it was for TDs in Perl. I bought the whole O'Reilly Perl series of books, which I barely touched, and I just when I moved out of LA, like I had to kind of dump them, and I gave them to somebody.
Right.
You know, it's probably like $500 worth of books.
Jesus.
So I started using Python actually for work at PDI. Mm-hmm. And then I think everywhere I went from that point, I was able to use it to some degree. And then there was the big kind of transition point where all the 2D and 3D packages kind of adopted it as a lingua franca. Yep. And then it was like, we were good.
You know? Right. Yeah, because everyone had their own language, right? You had MEL or MacScript or whatever. Now it's like, okay.
HScript, expression language. Houdini had like four, VEX, I mean, all kinds of stuff, you know?
Yeah, AutoCAD had Lisp.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, is not AutoCAD exclusive, but it's, you know, it's its own thing.
Oh, then Nuke was Tickle.
Oh, that's right. Tickle scripts. Yeah. It just sounded so dirty when you were doing a Tickle script. Tickle is TCL, by the way.
Yeah.
but yes, Tickle. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny because I know all this stuff, mm-hmm. and yet I don't script or code or anything. So,
Chris?
Yeah.
Learn to code.
Yeah, I should. Could. Why not?
I mean, even for customization stuff.
I used to do Pascal. I did some C++, or not C++, C.
Yeah.
Way back in the day.
All right. So you know how to code, you just haven't done it.
I haven't done it since college, and that's 27 years ago, probably.
Wow.
So it's been a while.
Yeah.
But I probably should pick it up again. Why not?
Yeah.
Something to do before I die, learn the script. okay. So. You mentioned a couple of things. You mentioned your time at Alias, et cetera, et cetera. But let's, you know, I always go through this because you have, like you said, listened to a couple of podcasts.
Yeah.
But I think people deserve the beginning origin stories of what got you to do what you kind of got into.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is that? Where does it start?
Well, it starts off when I was a kid. Can I pour a little bit more of this course. Before we dive into the origin story? Like
let's
every superhero needs an origin story, and then you'll get into the whole trilogy of it.
There you go.
I don't know if you can hear this through the mic, the gentle pouring of the
Rio.
Say
Rio it in Japanese, though.
Ryo.
Ryo. Ryo. Yeah. Is there an R sound in
yeah.
there? Ryo?
Yeah. Ryo. There's in Japanese, they organize the, like, their version of the alphabet, like, a, I, u, e, o, or the vowels, like, a, I, u, e, o, and then kaki, ku, ke, ko, and sashi, su, se, so, and so forth. Then you get to, there's ria, ryu, and ryo.
Okay.
And then ryu, long, means a dragon.
Okay.
But anyway.
Interesting.
My Japanese is a bit rusty at this point.
And what does ryo mean?
I'm not sure. Okay.
Does it mean something?
Well, it must be this character here, but I don't know that character.
Okay.
Yeah, ryo probably has multiple. Most sounds in Japanese have multiple meanings. A lot of it's because the characters come from Chinese.
Oh,
right. Yeah. Like my name, Ken. That's a common name in Japan for a man's name, Ken, like Kenichi.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah,
Ken,
yeah, yeah,
for short. But Ken can also mean a prefecture. It can mean a dog. It can mean a sword. There's a lot of different meanings, depending on which character.
Depending on how it's written.
Used. Yeah.
Interesting.
My favorite one is
kind of like sun and sun.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, pronunciation-wise, is the same. But yeah, written is different.
Yeah.
But kashikoi is the character that I use for Ken, which means smart.
Smart. Like, oh, there you go.
I like that. It looks cool. And I'm like, oh, that's a pretty good meaning. So if I write my name
in Japanese. Oh, so you can pick which version of the character you want to represent your name?
No, technically. Yeah, I mean, which character you want to use. Like, I wouldn't use the one for dog, right? But well, I guess I could, but yeah.
Someone might use it facetiously towards you.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Exactly. All right. Okay, all right. So when you were a kid.
Origins, yeah. Okay, so when I was a kid, I was really into science fiction. My brother and I both grew up watching Star Wars, Star Trek. I mean, I was 9 when the original Star Wars came out, before it was episode 4, right? So that, I remember sitting in the theater.
Was it always
episode 4?
Yep.
All right.
It starts off as episode 4.
Okay. I can't even remember now. It's been so long, but.
Yeah. Episode 4, A New Hope. Because I've seen it many times.
Okay. So, yeah. So have I. I just don't. Anyway. So we were sitting in the theater, and my mother took us, and even before we got to the cantina bar scene, she tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, I'm heading out for a coffee." Like, she didn't like the film. She went, I said, "I'll pick you up in the lobby." And I remember just watching that movie and thinking, my mind was blown. Like, I was literally taken on an adventure.
Right.
When the movie was done, all I wanted was to sit there and watch it again and again and again.
Right.
And my brother was the same way. So so that's kind of what got me into it. Then my dad was a language teacher, but photography was one of his hobbies. And he actually had a Super 8 camera.
Oh, yeah.
And so my brother...
And you're an older brother or younger brother?
Younger. He's a year and a half younger. So we're pretty close.
Yeah.
So we had actually, like, we wrote a script. I remember we wrote something called The Orb, which was a little script, like a spaceship came to Earth and whatnot. I was drawing out the spaceship. I was doing all, like, trying to draw all this stuff, you know.
Right.
So we took the Super 8 camera and we were out trying to make a movie. And I remember the only thing... The only point that we really got to was I remember being out in the backyard. We each took a baseball bat and I had my dad film it. And my brother and I would, like, pretend like they were lightsabers. Mm-hmm. And I had learned about this idea of rotoscoping. And so I went back, you know, and the Super 8 film, when you develop it, is this tiny, right?
It's 8 millimeters.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And
there's a reason it's called 8 millimeters.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, people can't see this, but with my fingers, I'm like, yes. And you qualified it by actually saying 8 millimeters. Yeah. But I was, like, with some kind of a Sharpie pen trying to rotoscope the baseball bats to make them look like lightsabers and being super disappointed when we played it back and it didn't look anything like it.
Right.
But anyways, that was the beginning.
So you were trying to basically just draw on the film.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I had read something saying that's basically how they did it.
Right.
You know? Obviously, there was a difference in technique
and
film and all that stuff, which I didn't really understand at the time.
Yeah.
But I ended up subscribing to Starlog magazine. And then when Cinefex came out, I subscribed to that. So actually, I have in storage Cinefex from, like, issue 1 up to, like, 20-something.
Hmm.
But that's kind of how it started. And then by the time I got to high school, well, the other big thing was, so there was...
And where was this?
In Monterey, California.
Monterey, okay.
Yeah.
So you're a California guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was Star Wars, obviously, huge influence. Star Trek, almost equal influence. And then there was all the Japanese stuff. And there was, for instance, Godzilla, which I thought was, you know, pretty amazing. But it was Ultraman was the one that, like, really somehow captured my imagination.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's awesome that you were so inspired by this, because these things were so great. And you were the perfect generation for mm-hmm. this, right? Like, this is the time when all of that was happening.
Well, this is a similar story for people who got into visual effects, right?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, right? Because those moments that happened back then, the Star Wars, the Ultraman, et cetera, yeah. that was part of an inspiring childhood,
mm-hmm.
which now people of our generation are all filmmakers, and we keep making these types of films.
Yeah.
You know?
The sequels, the remakes, sequels, all this
the remakes,
kind of stuff.
The reboots of things that we loved in our childhood.
The rehashing them.
Yeah, but you know what? I've gone on about nostalgia before in the past, as you know, since you mm-hmm. do listen to the podcast. But there is a reason that those things were so important to us. They mm-hmm. were really, there was like something we've never seen before.
Right.
Right. Those yep. were the turning moments. Right. Yeah. And I think that's awesome that those memories created the person you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everybody, you know, in their own time, something happens. Mm-hmm. And they gravitate towards something.
Right.
And hopefully it inspires them and it kind of leads them, it kind of helps them realize what it is they want to do in life, you know?
Right.
So after having seen that, I wanted to do special effects for film, like mm-hmm. practical effects, but more specifically, I love buying model kits, like those old AMT model kits yeah. of the Enterprise and, you know, ships from Star Wars and whatnot, Star Destroyer and whatnot, and buy it. And I was never really good at painting them, but what I used to try and do, and I had some good ones, was putting LEDs and fiber optics in them. And the whole idea of lighting things and having things glow,
right.
like, I don't know, I just loved it. Anything glows, like, I was in love with.
Right.
So I would try doing all of that stuff, sometimes more successfully or less successfully, depending on the model kit and how focused I was on it.
Right.
But eventually I got into high school and computers came on the scene. Oh. They were the TRS-80s, the trash 80s.
Yeah.
So I started learning how to program. They had a basic class, and yeah. I thought, wow, this is really cool. I kind of want to do this. And then I don't remember exactly, this is back in the mid-80s when I was in high school, and the young Sherlock Holmes was on TV.
Right.
And, of course, we all know that scene where the scene. The stained glass window knight jumps out.
It is the first CG character,
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that and thinking, what is that? How do they do that?
Although technically speaking, the first CG animated character, because I believe that the original Westworld was the first.
With Yul Brynner?
Yes, was the first CG character because it was like a 2D treatment on top of things.
Okay.
But they did it in some kind of a CG manner.
Possibly.
Yeah.
I've been meaning to go back and watch that because I've been watching the newer one.
I know. Anyway, yeah. So you saw young Sherlock Holmes.
And I thought, I discovered somehow that was computer graphics.
Right.
And I thought, oh, this is kind of doing special effects, making things glow and doing this and that, but it's on the computer. What a perfect match. That's what I want to do.
Right. And you need to figure this out in high school.
In high school. So then I ended up going to high school was at a place called Robert Louis Stevens. That was in Pebble Beach. It was kind of fun.
Right.
Neighbors, Monterey. And then I went to Santa Clara University to study computer engineering, not computer science, but engineering is kind of a mix between hardware and software. Mm-hmm. And when I was in school, the thing I found to be most fun, actually, was the hardware stuff and doing, like, assembly programming on, like, EEPROMs and CPUs and all this stuff. We had to build labs and that kind of thing. But when I graduated, I actually got onto I had some friends. I had a lot of friends from Hawaii in college. And some of them had gone to Japan on this program to teach English. And I thought, well, I definitely want to go to Japan because of the long-term interest in Ultraman and all that kind of stuff. I wanted to learn Japanese. And then I wanted to do computer-related work. So it just seemed like the perfect combo.
Yep.
So I ended up, right after school, I got accepted this thing called the JET program, Japan Exchange and Teaching Program. Yeah. So I went and spent 1 year on the JET program. Sort of in the boonies.
JET is sorry, say it again for those who don't know. It's Japanese English Teaching, right?
Japan Exchange and Teaching Program. Okay. Yeah. So they had two different positions. I was this called an AET, like Assistant English Teacher. So basically, the only requirement they had was you had some form of a degree and you were a native English speaker.
Right.
And you would go to Japan. You would be in a classroom with a Japanese teacher of English. And you were there to kind of help support them and to kind of teach the kids proper pronunciation and that kind of thing and mm-hmm. play games with them and get them more used to a native speaking the language and having them hear that firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for a year, and then English teaching was not my thing, but it was fun to do for the year. So I ended up getting, through my university, a job in Tokyo where I was programming Macintosh computers.
Mm-hmm.
This was like in 92.
Okay.
So I ended up, remember, I bought this whole... the toolbox books, you know, that was the Mac OS at the time.
Right.
So I was basically doing programming related to databases and that kind of thing. And then while I was there, I met somebody who started a company called BuildUp, which was kind of like a small version of ILM.
Okay.
They did, like, they made monster suits, like Godzilla-type monster suits for things.
Practical ones.
Yeah, practical ones. They made plastic model kits. And they were getting more and more into computer graphics. And he had three Silicon Graphics workstations. Mm-hmm. This guy started courting me, and I was like, well, this is great. I'm going to go and work there. But the longer, like, he would take me out to dinners, and we'd go to these hostess clubs, we'd drink and this kind of stuff, right. You know. But in the end, he really wanted me to help him expand his business in Asia because of the English and my Japanese at the time, which he thought was good enough for what he needed. So my only experience was going to be on the three boxes they had was at night, in the middle of the night, when they're not rendering anything and whatnot. And they were using something called what's the name of it? It's called Lynx was the name of the software. Okay. It was a Japanese software, computer graphics software. So he invited me to his wedding and said, hey, I want you to give a little speech in Japanese, which I did. And after that, two guys came up to me and said, hey, your Japanese isn't bad. We're from Sega. And you should come and have a look. And oddly enough, my mother used to send me a news article clipping she thought I'd be interested in. Okay. One of them, and you've interviewed these guys, Spaz Williams, right?
Oh, yeah.
It was an article about and that guy Mark Dupe, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It was about them and how they used a software called Softimage to animate the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park.
Right.
I finally had a name of a major, like, computer graphics software package. I had no idea what these people were using.
I thought they used Alias. No, Wavefront.
I thought it was Softimage.
I'm pretty sure they used Wavefront.
Okay. That article mentioned that it was Softimage.
Well, probably Softimage. I mean, who knows? I don't know. We can just go back and listen. Go back to episode whatever.
But when those guys from Sega approached me, they said, oh, we use Softimage. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go and check it out.
Right.
So that all worked out. I ended up getting a job there. But a funny tidbit to that one is I remember when I got there, so Sega at the time, again, mid-90s, was Softimage's largest client worldwide. And the reason, I think, being that there was a distributor there called Daikin, which is the same company, I think, that makes, like, the air conditioners and all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They took it upon themselves to translate all the manuals from English to Japanese and make it a lot more accessible to the Japanese, right? When I got to Sega, I was working, on the eighth floor or something. That hallway and the one above it, I remember, in the main hallway, it was just lined with those blue three binder sets for the original Softimage English manuals.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, my God. I just walked, okay, all right, I'm going to use that one. And I just pulled one off the wall.
Right.
And then I was hired as a programmer. But in my spare time, I was just learning Softimage.
Right.
Yeah. Softimage 3D, I think it was called.
Yeah. Well, see, this is the thing that's important because you're not the only person in that situation.
Yeah.
And this is something that us Gen Xers did,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Is we learned that if we have a passion for something,
mm-hmm.
we do it in our free time.
Right. We make the time for
it. We make the time for it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people now, they don't expect that. They expect that to be given the time to do what they want to do so they still have their free time to do whatever they want to do.
Right.
That's not learning.
That's not real passion.
No, it's not. So we did a lot of it. Back then, there weren't that many resources to learn these tools.
Mm-hmm.
So taking our free time and staying at work an extra couple of hours every day.
Yeah.
Is how we got things done.
That was the only way to do it.
Yeah.
When the computer system weren't being used by the people who normally were using them.
So many people did that. They started off as, you know, janitors, receptionists, whatever it was, and then learned the stuff on their free time.
Well, yeah, for the purpose of being in the right place.
Right.
To utilize that stuff when other people weren't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just look at Brian Grill, right?
Yeah.
You know, he's Academy now.
Yeah.
You know, started off as a janitor.
Yeah.
And that's how it is.
I mean, you do what you got to do, right?
Right, exactly.
And this is what I think is true passion. People have a plan. They know what they want. They figure out what they want to do, and they do what they need to do it.
Right.
You know? So it means going to that company. You're going to do this during the day, but it gives you access at night to work on systems that you would never be able to access otherwise.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So that was Sega. That was a lot of fun.
So how long were you at Sega? What year was this?
This was like 94 to 96, I think.
So Sega was pretty big then.
Yeah. I mean, it was a fun place for sure to work at the time. There was a small group of non-Japanese there, mainly mm-hmm. Americans. And so I had a lot of Japanese friends there. I had a lot of American friends. It was fun. But it was also cool because I got to get my voice in a couple of different games there.
Really?
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I wrote, the main guy who was my boss is actually, he's pretty well known in the games world, mainly in Japan, but also outside Japan. And so he had started a group called the Emotion Group or something. So that's what I was originally hired for. And I was working, I was doing programming, like network programming on SGI machines. So I was learning how to program on IRIX.
Right.
I remember buying this book.
SGI's version of Unix.
Exactly.
Right.
And I remember in a Japanese bookstore filing an English computer book section to buy this huge tome of a book called Motif Tools.
Oh, God.
Because I had to create UI front ends to the stuff I was
doing. Motif was their Qt in a sense.
Exactly. It was the whole UI.
It was the Qt version for SGI, yeah.
And they were doing a Sonic the Hedgehog, amusement park ride concept. Mm-hmm. And so basically on the small network of the group I was in, basically you had to guide Sonic on this path. And when it came to a certain area, there'd be a split in a road. Do you want him to go left or right kind of thing? And basically people would be tapping on their arrows to try to, you know, everyone independently, they want to go left or right. It would tally that up visually, like these arrows would get bigger and smaller on the screen. And then all the graphics were pre-rendered. They would be played back on an abacus. An abacus had some kind of API or something, so I triggered the abacus to then, if it went right, it would play the segment that would be the right, him, you know,
right,
running on the right side, that kind of thing. So that's how I got in there. And then they broke that up because they ended up scrapping that project. Mm-hmm. Then I ended up developing software tools. But I got to work mainly on this game called Sega Rally Championship. Okay. It was like an off-road rally game. So then they used my voice in that game. So that was the one game I had the voice in. And then I was in a group called AM3, AM standing for amusement. Mm-hmm. All these games were for arcades or game centers, as they call them in Japanese. And then the department below me was AM2. That was a really well-known one. That's where they made all the Virtua games, Virtua Fighter, Virtua Cop. When I got to Sega, it was like literally 1 or 2 weeks before the release of the first Virtua Fighter game.
Okay.
And I remember at Sega that as soon as the doors closed for the main business, they had one of those games in the lobby. Everyone would flock down and be playing the game. You know, it was pretty fun. But yeah, so I got the voice in Sega Rally and then also in Virtua Cop.
Wow.
So it's pretty cool, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just fun to be able to participate in those kind of ways over there as well.
Cool. And so you were mostly programming at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So developing software tools for the game teams. One tool I remember was to kind of help them visualize what the graphics would look like on an SGI machine. But so in other words, they could visualize on the SGI machine what the resultant graphics would look like on the board that would be in the game itself. And there was a group, I think it was out of Florida. It was either, it was one of the, what was it? Martin Marietta, I think. Sega somehow contracted that company. It's like an arms company and, you know, what's the term? Like it used to be in California with Lockheed Martin and all these companies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That they were developing boards to do their simulations and all that kind of stuff. Somehow Sega got in touch with them and would OEM their boards to be the motherboard in their games.
Right.
So I was doing some kind of tools related to that stuff.
Mm. Well, that's cool.
It was, yeah. I mean, I have to say I had a pretty good experience.
So was it through your Japan connection that you somehow got involved with Square?
Sort of.
Okay.
So after Sega, I ended up going to Alias Wavefront over there. They were building out their Tokyo Asia Pacific headquarters office.
Okay.
And I ended up doing that for about a year and a half. I transferred back through them to the States and to the San Francisco field office. And then I ended up getting a job at PDI.
Okay.
So that was the first kind of like post-production
graphics job I had. And what were you doing at what year was this at PDI?
That would have been like 99, I think.
Okay.
2000. No, like 97. No, I came back 97. 90, yeah, about 99 or so, yeah.
So PDI was already, they were doing big, what were some of the films they were doing?
Well, they had done Ants.
Ants, right.
And they were working on Shrek.
Okay.
So I joined their cafe group, and I was working on some TV commercial stuff, but then they had kind of a dearth of work there.
You'd know, actually, because this came up before. Mm-hmm. Who did the Listerine commercial? Was that PDI or Pixar?
Oh, I think that might have been Pixar.
Okay.
PDI was known for the Pillsbury Doughboy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They may have done a Listerine commercial, but they were known for having done all the early Pillsbury Doughboy.
Okay. Okay.
And I think Tide commercials, because when you got in there, you had to do, like, after training, you had to do a sample project, like right. You graduate from training, and it was based on the Doughboy or Tide stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. But after PDI, I went to Square.
So what were you doing at PDI? Were you working on Trek?
Yeah, well, we worked in the cafe group originally on some TV commercials, okay. And then the work slowed down there. They didn't get the first X-Men film. That fell through. So
interesting. So they were doing live action stuff. They were trying to get into.
Yeah. So CAFE was commercial and film effects. It was an acronym. So all
that's,
the stuff outside of
that's
full
not
CG.
CAFE effects though. That was in Santa Monica.
That was in Santa Monica.
I just didn't know if they were related to that.
It was. Yeah. It was just called the CAFE group. So they did a lot of TV commercials.
Okay.
And some of them were for other countries. Like, they did a lot of stuff in Japan and other places.
Right. Right.
But then they were bidding on X-Men and Minority Report.
Right.
I don't think either of those. Oh, no, Minority Report, they did do some work on, I think.
Interesting.
But anyway, there wasn't enough work, so they moved some of us over to help out on Shrek.
Okay.
So then I the majority of the time I was there, I worked on Shrek. And that was my first film credit, which was kind of fun.
Interesting. Yeah.
But before that was, before the movie came out, there was another guy there who later on had gone to Sony in L.A. and whatnot. But we used to play soccer together. And one time we were riding back, he said, "Hey, I want to let you know I'm leaving." And I said, "Oh, really? Where are you going?" And he said, "Square in Hawaii." And I said, "That's funny. I was just talking to him at SIGGRAPH."
Interesting.
Yeah. So he went out there. I went out about a
first
month later.
First of all, what a great deal that they set up something in Hawaii for you to work on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'd never been to Hawaii. Well, I've been to Hawaii once as a tourist, but
right.
I'd never had any idea of ever living there.
Yeah, I know. I know. So I guess that's where you met Prieg and all those guys, right?
Yeah. Actually, I met Prieger.
Prieger.
Okay. So there were two guys that were always together. They were kind of head of pipeline and other stuff as well.
Uh-huh.
Steve Prieg and Dave Seeger.
Okay.
But because they were always, they were collectively known as Prieger.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So Dave went on to become like a supervisor at Sony. He's been there for, he went to Albuquerque and was part of all that thing. And then
got it.
Yeah. But those guys were obviously very smart. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I knew Steve from out there. We used to play soccer out there.
Uh-huh.
And then a lot of other people.
So you're working on Final Fantasy?
Yeah, I was in the effects team there.
Okay.
So yeah, I got in there. So a lot of people, they had mixed feelings about Square because it was predominantly Japanese. About half the workforce was actually from Japan, the other half from other areas.
Mm-hmm.
I got there in the last year of Final Fantasy. So a lot of people who were kind of like disgruntled with that situation, they didn't understand the cultural barriers and whatnot. They had left already. I got out there and it was in the last year. I kind of like relished it because it was like a chance again to speak Japanese and hang out with these guys. And I also kind of bridged the gap a little bit here and there. So it was overall for me, it was a great experience.
Interesting.
And the movie was pretty exciting at the time. I mean,
yeah.
Again, with all the digital human stuff you're doing, I don't know what you're. It'd be interesting to hear your take
my
on
take
it,
on
at,
it
that,
is
at that time.
I think it was an unbelievably important movie for digital humans.
Mm-hmm.
And you can argue about the Uncanny Valley all you want.
Yeah.
But they were the first ones that even attempted to try to do something special.
Right.
And if it wasn't for them, then people, you know, would never have done it. So someone has to be the first one to attempt it.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think it was terrible. I actually think the movie was interesting. I think the movie, the digital humans were, I've seen far worse.
Yeah.
In recent years.
Yeah. I mean, given this was 20 years ago.
Yeah. Maybe, in almost. Recent years, I've seen far worse. But I think it was a groundbreaking film. And if it wasn't for that film,
mm-hmm.
the people that came out of that film, including people like you and mm-hmm. Steve Prieg and who else am I thinking of?
Well, Steve Galley came out of
Steve
there.
Steve Galley. He's a big guy now at Weta. Not at Weta. He's independent now. Who is the animation director on iRobot?
Oh, Andy Jones?
Andy Jones, yeah. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, yeah, Andy, great guy.
Andy
yeah.
Jones, is like, he knows so, he, you know, he yeah, knows yeah. a lot about animation and humans, et cetera. Yeah. Really, really talented.
Super cool guy, too.
Super cool. So all those people, they all mm-hmm. just have big talent.
Oh, sure.
And yeah. so they all came from that, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you can argue it's like, wow, Benjamin Buttons was so much better than Final Fantasy. It's like, well, you know, a lot of the same people kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And they've all evolved from the things that they learned, right?
Well, so, I mean, for instance, the case of Steve Preig in this case, I mean, right. It's a testament to the pipeline that he helped set up at Square.
Yes.
That he's taken it and set it up at other places as well.
Yes.
And people have actually, it's not just, hey, I'm going to set this up because this is what we did at Square. It's like people say, hey, I really love that system. Can we get that set up here?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's artists' feedback saying, hey, you know, that worked really well.
Yep.
You know, obviously you've designed something good here. We want to use it again and again.
Yeah. So, yeah. I learned a lot from him, you know, just.
Steve,
yeah. I mean, even in the early days at DD when iRobot, mm-hmm. you know, it was just pretty interesting.
You know, one thing, I haven't been in touch with Steve in a while now. I see some of his Facebook updates, but I don't even know if I should mention this here, but way back on when we were working on Tron, he mentioned an idea he had, which is now seeming to become more and more likely and popular, so I don't know if he ever pursued it, to digitally capture celebrities now for use in the future, to recreate them digitally as digital humans mm-hmm. with the quality level, you know, rendered in film that the average, you know, viewer would not be able to differentiate.
Right.
And I don't know, he had kind of a whole business idea, I think, behind it where you would approach the...
Right, it's like preserving people.
Exactly, yeah.
But it's also interesting because he is also actually, he and I have talked about the ethics of digital humans as well. And there's some question about that. Now, this is obviously with someone's consent, right?
You would, right.
Right? You would have to do that. But for example, there's a contract that someone has that...
Mind if I have a little more?
Of course. No, help yourself. What's the... Robin Williams has something in his will that he will never be recreated as a digital human.
Oh, interesting. So he had the foresight to...
Yeah, he said he does it. Something about it, like he or his family or someone retains the right of his image.
Yeah.
And they will not... recreate his image
in
a digital fashion.
Interesting. Way. I did not know that.
Yeah. I think that I'm pretty sure that's, well, I've heard it
from
someone. So I didn't read it. I don't know if it's a fact, but that's, I've heard that for sure. And then, you know, but he was also the one, I remember Steve telling me the story about someone at when DD was starting to get really big with digital humans back in the early days after Benjamin Buttons, et cetera, and we were bidding on bringing back, you know, Tupac from the dead. Okay, we did that. And then there was like, oh, let's bring out more people from the dead.
Right.
And someone apparently bought at some auction some memorabilia of Marilyn Monroe and found inside of this box, which was the memorabilia, there was a song that she recorded that he now owned because it was the only recording of it.
Interesting.
So he owned the copyrights of it.
Yeah.
And so this guy wanted to make a digital version of Marilyn Monroe and make some music video with her and
like
Justin
Timberlake. Like a posthumous.
And Steve's like, no, that's like he just didn't feel, he felt ethically he couldn't, he didn't feel right to do that. Just because that person is dead doesn't mean.
Never had the say.
Right. I mean, they do that. I mean, I feel the same way about the Cadbury commercials a little bit, you know, with the, what's her name? The actress in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
I see her face, but I
can't. Right, exactly.
We're both drawing a collective blank.
Collective blank. But anyway, they brought her back to do some Cadbury commercials.
Yeah, yeah. Was she in a? Was it a bus or something?
She was in a bus, and then gets into a car.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And then they did the same thing with Bruce Lee.
Bruce Lee, I was going to say, yeah.
And a whiskey commercial, and apparently
was it Audrey Hepburn?
Audrey Hepburn. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Audrey Hepburn. And then Bruce Lee, they did a whiskey commercial. Apparently, a lot of people took offense to that because...
Yeah. I don't think he drank or something.
He is an avid, you know, teetotaler.
Yeah.
So
imagine, you know, you've never smoked a cigarette in your life and you're brought back later, you know, smoking cigarettes. That'd be horrible.
Right.
It would not be... I mean, everything you represented in life is now
being... Or an anti-smoker or an anti-drinker Bruce Lee was, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, it just doesn't seem right. But, you know, whatever. People do things to... You know, with people dress up like Abraham Lincoln and sell mattresses.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
But most of these celebrities, there's some kind of a, either like a, I don't know, what would it be called? Like an estate or a foundation or something like that. The family members own the kind of the rights to the property of the person.
Yep.
So I think a lot of it is then determined by their surviving family members. And they probably just want to make money. And they're thinking, you know.
And they're probably doing that with Michael Jackson and Elvis and whatever
else.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But that's why it's interesting you brought up Robin Williams. He had the foresight to say, you know what? I don't want this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think it was, I mean, he died after Tupac.
Yeah.
So he knew that was a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is interesting because I think of the Tupac thing very differently, even though a lot of people say, well, it's the same thing with Tupac.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to me, first of all, I didn't.
You mean what Dee Dee did with?
Dee Dee did with Tupac.
Yeah.
But the way, you know, it doesn't matter who actually did the work. Mm-hmm. It's more about the fact it was done or the motivation for it to be done.
Right.
This was Dre and Snoop, right?
Snoop Dogg. Yeah.
And they wanted to bring their friend back from the dead.
Yeah.
Slightly nostalgically,
mm-hmm.
but they did it at Coachella as a surprise.
Right.
So they weren't actually, their goal wasn't necessarily to make money.
Yeah, yeah.
Because no one knew it was going to happen.
Right. They wanted to make an impression.
They wanted to make an impression.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, come see Tupac and we'll make money on Tupac.
Yeah, we're not selling tickets.
Right. So they did get the permit. They, you know, it's like, oh, we have this weird idea. We're going to try it. And there could be some ethics to it, and if you think about it, but I think the motivation was definitely well intended.
Yeah, I think also because when you think about it, Snoop Dogg and Dre was it?
Yeah,
they were probably all colleagues. They were probably friends. Yeah, they hung out.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So if anyone said, "Hey, I want to do this with the image of this person." Mm-hmm. Even more than family members and whatnot, those would probably be the right people.
Exactly.
And if there was anything wrong about it, they would probably have shot it down very quickly.
Yes, I think so too. So I think that there's something about that. That they were doing. But I mean,
they would have known him better than other people. You know?
Yeah.
What he would have wanted, what he would have not wanted.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh.
So anyway, that's my general feeling about it. But yeah, so that's, you know, that's you. Sorry, it's a long way around. But
yeah.
But what was going on at Square and how they started thinking about digital humans, I think it was an important turning point.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember all the different characters.
I do. I don't remember them by name.
Yeah. Well, there was one name. Well, there's Aki, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And the other main one was Sid. One of the other main ones. He was the old kind of scientist. Yeah. So I don't know if you ever saw. So with there were a couple of pretty talented guys there that had worked on all this stuff, like all the texture maps for the face and the pores and the freckles and all that kind of stuff. There was a magazine called Maxim.
Yes.
Did you ever see?
They did.
They rendered a version of Aki naked.
Right.
For Maxim, did you see that?
I have actually. I don't remember why, but I have.
Right. But I mean, the quality of that work at the time, I thought was pretty well done.
Right.
I mean, they had her basically as a real centerfold or whatever they did for that magazine.
Right.
As opposed to a real human.
Right.
You know, and then Sid, like, so I got there, you know, I met some of the main, like each character had an animator.
Mm-hmm.
But the one who had done Sid had already left by the time I got there. So again, I was only there for the last year, but apparently that the guy who did Sid had like redone the whole thing. And if you watch the movie, I think the Sid character is one of probably the more accomplished as far as animation is concerned, mm-hmm. with all the facial expressions and hand movements.
Interesting.
Some
I
of them
see it again.
Because
you know,
it was motion.
It's been years
capture,
and
you know?
Years and years since I've seen it. So I really should see it again, especially in this context.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're like a digital human.
You're
at the core of that.
I love that. Yeah.
You have the whole initiative and all that stuff. So it would be interesting to go back in points in time how does this hold up? What did they do as far as, you know, animation details and things like that?
Yeah. Speaking of fake humans taking on roles to influence humans, like the Maxim thing you were talking about. Have you heard of Little Michaela?
Yes. Only recently.
Isn't that weird?
Oddly enough.
Yeah.
These are like Twitter celebrities, right? Is it Twitter Instagram. Or Instagram? Sorry.
And they're fake CG.
Yeah. My girlfriend has been in. She's been in a number of startups recently, and she works as a head of product and digital marketing in some pretty high-profile companies for young women, as far as fashion and makeup and that kind of thing. So part of her job would be to hire influencers, like in YouTube and other things, and they'd pay these people a lot of money to get like 10 seconds of a product advertisement in there, like those. The listeners can't hear this, but your flip flops.
Yeah, I'm wearing very LA Reef flip flops. Yeah,
there you go. Yeah. So if there was some
there's a product placement for your Reef.
Yes, exactly.
I did not get the ones with the bottle openers on the bottom, but they're very comfy.
You can move up later. Yes. But imagine if you're doing something, you get a YouTube influencer who's got hundreds of thousands of viewers, and you mention that product for only 10 seconds, your sales will go up, right?
Right. Sure.
So they'd pay these people a lot of money. But
they also have to pay the modeling fees.
Sure. They got.
That's why Lil Miquela is popular, because you don't have to pay a modeling fee.
Right. So she was very interested in this concept that I hadn't even thought of it, honestly. But you could render a character sort of photorealistically, but when you look at it from my eye anyway, it's not photorealistic. But for my girlfriend and maybe other people, they look at it, they think, oh, this is either real or it's real enough. I like it. Mm-hmm. And I like the advice they're giving and whatnot. I like the products they're advertising. You could like cut out, in this case, sort of a middleman, and you're talking about the modeling fee and whatnot, to come up with you'd be better at this than I am for sure. Mm-hmm. You could render your own in V-Ray. Let's plug V-Ray here. Yeah. You could use V-Ray to render some model.
I think Lil Miquela is actually rendered in V-Ray.
Okay.
I think she is.
You got to get that person on the podcast.
Well, I actually I met with him.
Okay.
But I'm trying to get him on the podcast. I think there's, because of some weird press that's going on recently about it, he's not necessarily going to talk about it, but maybe someday.
But imagine the ad campaigns you come up with. As long as you get enough traction with that. Mm-hmm. And there was a competitor. I forgot. In the same article I read about the other one.
And it's another digital character.
Yeah, another digital. And
so it turns out they're both by the same people. So it's a fake rivalry.
Oh, I didn't know that. There's some kind of advertising agency, right?
Yes, but there's a fake rivalry between two digital characters. One of them is like, admit it, you're a digital character. Right. It's like, but yet so are you.
Yeah.
And they're not, so it's just enough to create tension and get more influencers.
Yeah, yeah. But what I did notice on this Miquela character, some were close-ups of the face. But
she's a strange-looking girl.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. She's like ethnically indistinguishable. You can't distinguish.
You cannot profile.
Yeah.
But you could tell definitely there were a number of pictures. There were real pictures where they basically comped her face onto it. Mm-hmm. So that kind of gives the overall impression that it's something real.
Right.
If they get the face done well enough, lighting-wise and all that, to match the photograph that they're comping it into.
Right.
Because when you look at the legs and the clothing and all that, it's like, no, that's an actual photograph.
Right.
You know, so, but the whole concept of doing that and getting your friend to model and then replacing the friend's face with this thing and getting traction behind it is pretty ingenious, I think.
I think it's part of me, you know, your the normal reaction that you would get is like, I can't believe this is happening in the world.
Right.
Right. That some CG character is out there in a social network, which is really was designed for you to share pictures of your kids and your dogs and vacation.
Yeah.
To suddenly having a digital character that's advertising Evian water and you know, chocolate croissants at your local whatever.
But you know, all these social media outlets, you know how much money is put behind them by all these companies to basically leverage them as platforms.
Because the traditional means of advertising is dead.
Mm-hmm.
Television is a dead product at this point. Yeah. A lot of people don't want to admit it, but it's dead.
Yeah.
So making TV commercials is a non-thing, right? Yeah. Targeted advertising is way more effective.
Yep.
And so social media is the
best place. Until you deactivate cookies.
Right. Yeah. No, I actually prefer targeted advertising.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'd rather get an advertisement that's interesting
that's
to me
relevant
as opposed to, you know, toilet paper commercials, which I don't care about on TV.
Imagine you get an ad, targeted ad for a new type of mic you could use here that would better use the podcast.
And I actually do get those types of advertisement. And I would click on it.
Yeah.
Because like, huh, I mean, tell me about that.
Exactly. I'm not fervently against this because they surface things that actually have meaning.
Yeah.
You know?
Although it is weird when I looked up some information about how to disassemble a bathroom faucet.
Right.
Like, you know, a special kind of faucet, and looked up some YouTubes about it.
Yeah.
And then I'm reading some article about, you know, our president or something, and then some faucet commercials comes up.
Okay. It's a little disconcerting.
Yeah.
But
it feels like a little bit of an invasion of my privacy, but this is something I
technically
volunteered.
Exactly. And if you really want to opt out of it, just don't go online.
Yeah, And see how good your life is after that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, it could be good, but after a while, you'll need to buy something from Amazon.
Yeah, yeah. We've been buying a lot recently. We moved, so.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, a lot of stuff. Shower heads and
nice. Oh, so when did you move to this new place?
We're still in the middle of the move. We moved, but we haven't unboxed a lot of stuff.
Okay.
It's a new construction building, so there's a lot of stuff we're still waiting for them to finish before we can actually unbox stuff to, like, put it in and get. We have to get, like, a storage set up and all this kind of stuff.
So, okay. Yeah. All right. All right. So, Square. We're back at Square.
Yeah.
It's back to square one.
nice. Nicely done. Cheers.
Cheers.
You can hear that one. You know what? It just, I mean, this is almost like going back to DD times. It's like a highballers for two with some hopefully titillating conversation.
Yes. Well, you know, I think that's maybe one of the first seeds that got put in my head to do this podcast.
Yeah.
Is that we would, highballers was a DD, as you know, and we would go outside. I've mentioned it on the podcast many times before. We would go outside on, I think it was Wednesdays, and we would have different kinds of whiskeys, and we would talk, and it was hanging out, just kind of like what we're doing right now.
Exactly.
And I think Daniel Buck would say, because D-Buck, I think D-Buck, Lupacora would always have entertaining stories.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel Buck said, it's like, we should just have a camera out here and record these conversations because they're hilarious.
Yeah.
And I think that got me the idea is like, maybe these conversations are hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think that's when I started thinking about podcasting. I was like, I should just do what we do with Highballers.
Exactly.
And do that.
Yeah. So, and have a nice combination of old colleagues plus
new colleagues, new friends,
colleagues,
find out old stories I didn't know about.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're probably going to, we're way over, but are you cool with running a little long?
I am.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I came all the way to LA, so.
Yeah, I know. You literally, he just to let us know, you said, I was like, I'm going to be in LA. We can do a podcast. I was like, fantastic. And so you literally planned your trip to land at LAX and just take your Uber directly to the office.
Yeah. Cause you're in Culver, even though you live in Burbank, right?
Yeah.
Cause the original flight was to Burbank. We said, you know, it's just doesn't work out timing wise. Come to the office in Culver City.
Right.
So we switched the flight.
Yeah.
To LA.
So it's great. And then I'll just drive you over to your where you're staying after this.
So what can we discuss that's again interesting for the listeners?
Well, we still have to go back to square one.
Oh.
So
all right.
When you left Square obviously sort of closed down in Hawaii, right? Were you still there during that time?
Yeah. So they announced that after that, they didn't make the money on the film or whatever. They weren't going to do too much more, but they were going to do the Animatrix. So,
right, and Angie Jones was on that too.
Yeah. So
now, the Animatrix was amazing to me because, again, that was like we learned so much from Final Fantasy. Animatrix was a step above that. Yeah.
So I ended up staying to work on some of the initial development for the Animatrix, but then I left.
Right.
And then I actually went back to Japan to see the premiere of Final Fantasy in Japan because it's originally from Japan. And then I took about a year off in total. Actually, so I went to Japan. That's when 9/11 happened.
Oh, wow.
And my original flight back obviously was canceled and delayed and all that. It was really surreal to be in Japan when that happened because I remember I went out to dinner with some friends and that night, on my way home from dinner to the place I was staying, they were texting me on the phone. Japanese phones were much more advanced at the time than U.S. ones. Did you see what's happening on TV? I got all these, voicemails and texts and stuff. I got back to the place. I turned it on, and the first plane had hit, but the second one hadn't hit yet.
Right.
I was like, holy shit. I called my mother back, in California, woke her up because of the time difference. She hadn't been up yet.
Yes, because it happened So I was in LA too. I just moved to LA.
Okay.
And I was in the same boat because my, I guess, alarm went off or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it had radio on it or something.
Right.
And so I was like, you know, it was, so yeah, the radio, yeah, is, yeah, like the old fashioned alarms where the radio come on, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I was like, something's wrong. Like the news, mm-hmm, is going on. It sounds really bad. And I said, something's going on. So I woke up my wife and I said, something's not right.
Yeah.
And we turned on TV and same time. So you and I were at,
yeah,
the same time.
Yeah.
First,
yeah,
plane hit, second plane hadn't hit yet.
Right.
And like, what the hell's going on?
I remember calling my mother and saying, you got to turn the TV on.
Right.
And it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. It was, right, so devastating and so sad. But the other thing I learned,
what was weird to me also, sorry, but yeah, I was kind of in shock, obviously, as a lot of people were.
Mm-hmm.
Our next door neighbors who were good friends of ours, we got them up. We just started watching it together and we're like, what the hell? And at this point, both towers were hit.
Right.
I got on the phone with my mother. She lives in the East Coast.
Okay.
And we're talking and we're looking and it's like, I just don't understand how this happened.
Yeah.
And we're looking at the TV together and then the reporters aren't saying anything because they're just CNN talking, right?
Right. Because
they're just going through whatever. And as I'm watching the live feed, the building collapses. The first building collapses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my mother and I said, oh, I just, the whole building just
imploded, basically.
Imploded.
Yeah.
And the people who were watching, or the CNN guys or whatever who were it, like,
yeah,
they hadn't even reacted to it because they weren't paying attention or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just like, it was just me going, did you just see that?
Yep.
Like, you know, yeah, yeah. It was really weird.
Yeah. It was just surreal.
Yeah.
So,
So you were stuck there, I guess, because it was, yeah, like weeks.
I ended up being there in like an extra 2 or 3 weeks.
Right.
But the thing that was really interesting, I mean, it's odd to use the word interesting about something like this, but the Japanese didn't censor anything. So I ended up buying like a bunch because I thought, you know, this is, unfortunate as it is, it's an historic event. I bought like a lot of, Japanese are prolific with news magazines and things. Mm-hmm. So I bought newspapers, magazines, all this kind of stuff. They had very graphic images on the covers of all these magazines and things. When I finally got back to the States, they had kind of like cleansed everything, right?
Right.
So I have a bunch of stuff from Japan that shows the graphic nature of the event, mm-hmm, that I think they quickly brushed over a cleanse in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, it was awful. It's awful. Right.
I did a podcast with a guy named Mickey Willis,
mm-hmm,
I met him at THU.
Mm-hmm.
He's a director and stuff, and he was in New York during 9/11,
yeah,
and ended up being thrust into being a volunteer during that time.
Okay, yeah,
and it's completely changed his life.
And
he talks very vividly about that.
Emotional
response.
Yeah.
He mentioned how graphic it was.
Yeah.
But you know, not in a way that he's trying to gross you out, but more about like, shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
I mean, what can you
200 story buildings collapse? It's going to be a lot of carnage.
I mean, honestly, that's a whole other conversation as to what really happened there. But that was when I was in Japan after Square.
Uh-huh.
And then I came back. I went to Italy to study Italian for a while. So that was kind of fun.
Okay.
And so something a little bit more lighthearted. Had a good time there. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's time for one more pour. Okay. And then came back and worked at Tippett. So I was up in this area. I was working on the third Matrix film. So that was fun. And then I got an invite to come down to LA to work on X-Men 2.
Okay.
So I ended up, it was my former, effects supervisor at Square. And I love that guy.
So when you were at Tippett, did you know someone named Michael Johnson?
Mm-hmm.
It's
funny. You know what?
Him last night.
You know why I know him?
Why?
When I had left, he came in to replace me. I think.
Oh, really? Yes. He said he mentioned, I met him last night because we were chatting about stuff, and he said that you were kind of his sensei over at Tippett.
Sensei.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we had a little bit of an overlap when I left. And I went down to L.A. to work on X-Men 2. It was my first actual live-action film. So that was fun.
Really? That's, okay, I guess that's true. Because
it was Shrek and Final Fantasy, and then it was the third Matrix film, but it was like almost an all CG sequence.
Got it.
But here's one thing I'm gonna throw out about Tippett. Mm-hmm. The visual effects supervisor at the time was Craig Hayes.
Okay.
And one thing he did, which wasn't great time wise for people, everyone went to dailies at once. Okay. Right. So you heard all the comments from rotoscope, you know, dust busting to animation,
right,
to effects, to modeling, to comping. They mandated that everyone went to dailies at the same time. So it was very educational to hear all the comments he would make about all the different disciplines. And he was a very insightful guy.
You don't need dust busting anymore.
Well, yeah. But I mean, the whole gamut, right?
Right.
And he was very insightful. Again, a very smart guy. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting to hear all of his comments across the whole gamut of disciplines.
Right.
So that was good about Tippett. Mm-hmm. And then I went down to L.A., worked at CineSite with my effects supervisor from Square, mm-hmm. and that was great. And then
CineSite, were doing,
it's part of Kodak. We were working on X-Men 2.
Right. So you were John Hewitt.
Yeah. You know John.
Yeah, I do know John. In fact, that's a great. I should get John on this podcast. He's
okay, I'm gonna mention something in a second.
Okay.
So.
Because John's got that car stuff going.
I love John.
Oh, he's amazing.
We did, for like 3 years in a row, we did Venice Ale House on Fridays for lunch, you know, without exception.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And we had a group that would
right
go down
there. Yeah.
Yeah. Right down from DD.
Yeah. Good beer.
Oh, yeah.
Although he
and,
went on
and
a
organic
beer,
food.
Yeah. He went on a beer hiatus for a while.
And then back on it.
Yeah, he's back
on it. He's an IPA guy.
Okay.
I don't do the IPAs. He doesn't.
I don't
the
like IPAs.
Neither do I.
Okay.
Yeah. We're doing Scotch and nice.
Okay.
Do it.
Well, you know what? Actually, Ken, do me a favor because I'm not gonna I don't think I have his email.
Yeah.
Can
you I'll get you in touch.
Give me a touch with John.
Yeah.
Because John would be great. Is he still in LA?
Yep.
Okay, then definitely need to get John on.
We'll catch up with him after the podcast.
Sure.
Okay. So so from CineSite. In either Variety or Hollywood Reporter, a story came out saying that Kodak was shutting down CineSite in LA.
Yeah.
And I thought, what? They didn't tell us anything. Monday morning, there was a quick impromptu meeting. Uh-huh. You know, we're so sorry, but what you read is true. We're shutting it down. So we're just going to finish off the projects we're on and that's it. Sorry, folks.
Right.
But after that, they actually had a bunch of people from DD, Sony, and other R&H, other companies come in, interview people, try to help people transition from their company to others.
Right.
So it was through that I met Darren Grant.
Oh, right.
And he said, you know, we had the initial, you know, interview there. He said, hey, you know, why don't you come over to DD? We'll interview you there. So I did that one. I went to DD, and it was kind of funny because I ended up basically being interviewed by the dual Darrens, let's say. Darren Grant and Darren Handler.
Okay.
And Peter Pilavridis.
Yeah. Peter P.
Yeah, Peter P. Who I knew briefly from PDI. Uh-huh.
So, that's right. He was,
He was there in the cafe group. So I interviewed with them, and they got back to me pretty quickly saying they got this project Peter Pan, my experience would be good for that, blah, blah, blah. So I ended up going to DD. And
interesting.
From that point forward, I worked on the West Side. And I worked at DD on and off for about 10 years. And basically, I was working on a freelance basis. So I'd work on a project at DD.
I think that so Peter Pan was probably your first mm-hmm. gig there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was on Day After Tomorrow. You were on Peter Pan.
Yeah.
Day After Tomorrow was my first film.
Yeah.
And then I guess a bunch of the Peter Pan guys moved over to iRobot. And then when
I moved over to iRobot.
Right. And then that's where we worked together. And then, and then obviously the well-known story about what happened with Day After Tomorrow.
Yep.
So I moved over to iRobot as well. And that's when we started working together.
Yeah, exactly.
What was your job on iRobot? You were a
effects
TD. Right.
Yeah, I was an effects TD. I was working with Spencer Alexander.
Oh, yeah.
And we were doing like when the robot was being shot by gunfire, all the debris coming out of the robots. But at the same time, I was interested in doing lighting.
Right.
Which you're a lighting guy.
Right.
I was in effects. I was trying to transition over to lighting a little bit, gain that skill set.
Mm-hmm.
But it was funny. They gave me a couple of shots which had a very strange color palette. And I remember, you know what I got to do is I got to match that color palette, because whoever modifies that in DI or comp afterwards would want everything in the same color space, and they would do the transition all at once.
Right.
And I got a lot of advice by, I'm sure it's a mutual friend, Ricardo Zanettini.
Ricardo, oh my God, Ricardo is very sick, I heard.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he had a stroke.
Oh, Jesus, I didn't know that.
I think he's doing better. I've only had Facebook updates.
Okay.
And I've tried to communicate here and again, but I'm sure they're very busy with all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate.
He's a very talented guy.
He is very talented, yes.
He kind of looked like the Count.
He was the Count.
The Count from Sesame Street.
Yes, one, two, three.
One, two, three, Ricardo.
Yeah.
Ricardo was a really talented guy.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he's still talented.
He's still talented. Well, yeah. Back at the time when I knew him, he was a very talented person.
But
and he was a really... very charismatic,
yeah,
you know, like an Italian guy.
But I would turn to him. Yeah. I say, hey, what should I do here? I'm new at all this. Well, yeah, you're on the right track. You know, you want to do like this, but look, the original scene doesn't look right. So you match that, and then they'll fix it all. You know,
right.
So this kind of thing. So I went with his advice, which was in the end, I think, worked out.
Right.
So yeah, worked on iRobot, and then worked on a number of different productions there. And then basically, from DD, I would branch out because I'd work on a contract basis. I was more interested in the projects as opposed to the company, so I would jump from company. But basically, the way it worked out was I would be a DD on a company on a project, and then that would finish. I would go to another company on a project, and that would finish. I come back DD because they had the next cool project to work on.
Right.
So it was like back and forth to DD. So I went to a few different companies in LA, R&H, Hydraulics, Asylum,
mm-hmm.
places like that. And then the last place I worked at in LA was Bad Robot.
Oh, right.
I have to say that was one of the most amazing, unbelievable.
I've actually been there.
I'm sure you have, because your friend Andy Wexler is it?
Waisler.
Yeah,
he was one of the people that
he helped architect the place,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I remember meeting him at DD, and he showed up at Bad Robot a couple times while I was there.
Mm-hmm. I think he's actually related to JJ.
Oh, maybe, I don't know.
I think I may be completely off the wall here, and I can get slapped for it or whatever.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. But I'm going to just go throw it out there. I think that his wife is sisters with JJ.
Could be.
Brother and sister.
That I don't know.
But in any case, Andy Waisler, who has been on the podcast, he was my CG supervisor, my boss, basically, when I was on Day After Tomorrow.
Mm.
And he was an ex-architect as well.
Well, you had mentioned that he brought you into DD, right? Or
no.
help do that?
Well, the person that actually brought me in was Eric Hansen.
Oh, okay.
So Eric Hansen was the one who said, here's this VHS tape at the time.
Yeah.
Here is this demo reel.
I love Eric.
We need to interview this guy. Then Andy Waisler was the person who would eventually hire me.
Okay.
Looked at the demo reel and said, I like it. He's an architect.
Yeah.
I used to be an architect.
Yeah,
let's hire him.
And okay.
So he was the one who basically gave me the thumbs up.
Yep.
What's interesting is Andy's one of the only people I know who went from architect to visual effects back to architecture.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's when he designed JJ's Bad Robot's office, right?
Yeah.
And what's so cool about it is that, one, he's an architect, so he knows how something to work. Two, he understands how a visual effects company works and how a creative company works.
And also lighting in an environment.
Yeah, and so he made a really interesting space that is a lot of fun to hang out in.
The place is awesome. And not only because of the lighting and the overall design, but because of all the stuff JJ has out on display.
Yeah, but he made spaces for it, right?
Yeah.
So he thought about it. It's like, I know how geeky guys like us are.
Yeah.
We want a space for all our toys. And so you walk in to Bad Robot.
Yeah.
And I think there's something what's the doorbell for, there's a doorbell.
Yeah. It says, are you ready?
Are you ready? Which is in One and Lost.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you click the button and then you open the door and you're inside and you're surrounded by toys.
Yeah, exactly. JJ's collection. And they rotate it. They have like massive storage units, and they rotate all the displays and stuff.
Yeah, and so you're like, it's a nerd's wet dream.
Exactly.
Right.
And imagine I'm a nerd. I had a wet dream
exactly.
On a daily basis.
Exactly. It's like, you know, Star Wars, Ultraman, all that stuff.
That's the only place I can think of in my whole career where I thought I never want to be sick to miss a day here because you never know what's going to happen.
Right.
They had you can't even imagine all the people who would come in and out of that place.
Yeah. It was.
Yeah. But in my whole career, I told you in the beginning, my brother and I grew up watching Star Wars and Star Trek. I never had an opportunity to work on either of those franchises in my whole VFX career until I got to Bad Robot. I worked on both. And the fact that JJ was the director of Episode 7 while I was there, I mean, it was a whole nother experience to be in the actual production company.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I had pumpkin pie and Thanksgiving with, like, Kylo Ren and what is Daisy Ridley's character again? Rey.
I was there helping out for some VRA stuff they were doing there. And then who was there? JJ just got back from doing something on Episode 7.
Okay.
And who's English actor from Star Trek?
Simon Pegg.
Simon Pegg.
Yeah.
Simon Pegg showed up.
Yep.
And then they had their catered lunch, which was delicious.
You mean the lunch they do there, the two executive chefs?
Yeah, they have three executive chefs, and so the entire...
It was
the
John
entire,
and Mike.
Yeah. The entire building is fed perfect, beautiful food.
Yeah,
and so I texted my wife, like, J.J. Abrams is here with Simon Pegg. But the best part of the day is how delicious this risotto is.
Yeah.
and she says, really? And it's like, really? The risotto? Yeah. And goes, Simon Pegg? And goes, that's how good this risotto is.
that would be because at the time, John and Mike, the chefs.
Right.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And they would provide, you know, they'd do the lunches and they do the afternoon snacks, which are great. Yeah.
Yeah. They're super nice there.
Oh, yeah. Everyone was super generous and nice.
Yeah. And, it, you know, basically, like, they're saying, oh, we're wondering if you can come by and help us with some V-Ray stuff or whatever.
It's
Yeah. That sounds like a pretty good day. Yeah,
I could go back and back and back.
Sounds like a pretty good day. Sure. I'll help you out.
I'm going to tell you one. Can I tell you two stories about that place?
Of course.
Okay.
I mean, can you?
Oh, yeah.
Some NDAs, I'm sure.
Oh, no. At this point, it's all good. That place is really like you're talking about. It was like a dreams come true environment.
Right.
And so, as I said, when I was a kid, my brother and I watched Star Wars, right? And then all these years later, I finally got to work on one of the Star Wars films. JJ was directing it. It was at the production company. They did pickup shots there, all this kind of stuff.
Right.
I was eating pumpkin pie with these stars of the show. I met Carrie Fisher, saw Harrison Ford, all these kind of things.
Jesus.
And then, seriously,
look, let's go back to the, what is it, you know, an hour and 20 minutes
ago. Yeah. Like some of the podcasts I've listened to. What was I going to say exactly?
You made all your heroes.
So they told us, you know, please don't take pictures of people. Don't ask for autographs, this kind of stuff. I'm like, of course, I'm not going to go.
They
want to
be.
Right?
They want to be. That's their safe place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, these are friends of this JJ's. They come in here. This is a work environment. It's a professional environment. You have the privilege of working here. Don't ruin it. Right. And I thought, okay, obviously, I'm not going to do that.
You know, I will just tell you one further. Right. Because they said that probably in a very nice way at Bad Robot. When I worked at Sony and I had to go on the, you know, we could go on the lot if we wanted to have lunch there or whatever because we worked at Sony. We had to sign things that said, you will not talk to talent unless spoken to.
Right.
So like they had specific rules. You could get fired for going up to someone because you recognize them.
And I'm posing on them for a couple of minutes,
No, for a second.
For a second.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't want to do any of that.
Of course.
That place was so amazing. I didn't want to jeopardize my position there at all. But I thought, you know what? I kind of fantasized about this. If this one individual ever came in and the opportunity presented itself, I would break a couple of rules. And if they fired me, so be it. Mm-hmm. That opportunity, magically enough, presented itself one day.
Okay.
I went up and introduced myself to the maestro, John Williams.
Oh.
And I said... I shook his hand. Like, I approached him, and he put his hand out immediately as if I'm somebody, you know? Mm-hmm. Shook his hand. I said, Maestro Williams, I said, thank you so much for literally a lifetime of wonderful music. so many of them are committed to memory here. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, because of you, also I'm you know, kind of an amateur brass player. And he made some comments.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I play trumpet and French horn to some, I mean, limited degrees, wow. but because of all the music. And he made some comment about busting my chops and this kind of thing, you know. Right. But it was just, where else would that happen, you know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
That place was really, honestly, a dreams come true environment.
Yeah. It's a really cool building.
Yeah. Too. And then one last thing.
Yeah.
Is the fact that I finally got my name in Star Wars in the credits.
Wow. Right?
Not only that, but later on, as a long story, I won't go into it, I got my brother's name as my middle name. So I kind of got my name and my brother's name, having grown up loving Star Wars, into the canon, so to speak.
From the origin stories.
Yeah.
To doing that.
Yeah, exactly. Come full circle.
Come full circle.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing, Ken. Yeah.
I don't know how much this has added to your community of listeners, but...
I know. Well, I love the fact that we've gone from that origin story, starting with your Star Wars thing, mm-hmm. to getting your credits in Episode 7 with your brother.
Exactly, yeah.
As your mother's getting a cup of coffee outside.
That's
because
right.
Because she doesn't
like
this movie because it's boring.
It all worked out. And as my dad says,
yeah,
whatever happens, whether, you know, good or bad, it all works out for the best. And if you have that mentality, you can't lose.
Yeah. Yeah, everything, yeah. All the, I always say this to myself sometimes, like.
Yeah.
There's probably.
I like that we say that. I always say that to myself sometimes.
That's funny that I said that. I just realized how stupid that is. No matter all the bad things that happened to me.
Yeah.
Because one of meeting my wife is like a very pinnacle moment for my life,
sure.
right? Because she's an amazing person. But all the bad things that happened to me that before I met my wife, I don't regret. Because if they had...
Had that happened,
I may not have met my wife.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the same thing could be said of any other moment in your life. Like, you know, if all those bad things hadn't happened, I probably wouldn't be doing the things. And right now, I'm pretty happy. Look at this.
Yeah.
We're sitting in this chair. We're exchanging great old stories. We love what we do.
Yeah. And you've got this great job going. You got a great podcast going.
Yeah. And you live on the 14th floor and you're watching free concerts through binoculars.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wondering what I'm going to do next in life.
Like the Jeffersons.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think they're right. There's all these weird things that happen, you know, Square not closing down and all these. Yeah. So, it's cool.
Yeah.
Well, Ken, this has been great. We've been wanting to do this for a while. I'm so glad we could do it in person the office.
In the office, It's great to see the office here.
Yeah.
Great setup you got going. I love your job. I'm envious.
Don't be envious.
Don't
be envious. You have to travel a lot of miles sometimes. I think I put on already 60,000 miles this year. And it's,
as long as you're getting all the points on the cards and all that kind of stuff.
I'm getting frequent flyer miles, but I'm not getting points on the cards. The company gets those because they go on the company card.
Oh, I got it. That's a whole other story that I, at Alias when I was there, it all worked out well, but yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, try to maximize the situation.
Yeah.
Now, in closing,
yeah,
I think you had mentioned in some podcast that you kind of based yours on the Nerdist podcast. Is that right?
Yeah. So what... Because I've always had this interest in podcasting because I listen to them on my drive.
Right.
And the Nerdist is when I listen to lots of Nerdist podcasts, and what they had said was it really wasn't that hard because we decided to just record a conversation and not edit it.
Right.
And I was like, right.
Yeah.
So
just let it be freeform.
Freeform. So if I don't edit conversations, if I don't worry about editing, then it's gonna work out.
Yeah.
So that was my inspiration.
Yep. So in closing, if it's unedited, and we've had a good deal of the real. I know Chris, I don't know him personally, but I know he ends it by saying he's got his own phrase, right?
Right. He does.
You remember that?
Yes. He says, enjoy your burrito.
That's right.
Right.
I think you should come up with a phrase.
Well, I did used to have one.
Oh, really?
I did. And
what was it?
It was called Let the Last Bucket Drop.
Oh, that's part of the theme song, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
But I started not using that.
Okay.
Because we were using a lot of progressive rendering recently, so there's not going to be as many buckets anymore.
But you're still dealing with rays, right?
We are. So if you, it's a good call to action.
Yeah.
To listeners.
Yeah.
To think of a good way to sign off.
Yeah, have some competition. Come up with a new sign off phrase.
Okay.
I'm going to suggest one.
Yes.
And then you'll start the process.
Okay. Yes.
May all your rays render.
May all your rays render.
And what that means in this community is, you know, just relax and let it happen what happens.
I have another, let's just, okay.
Yeah.
Because this brought up, may all your rays render is that's a really good way to describe biased rendering.
But I'm trying to be unbiased. I don't do any profiling or biasing or anything.
Now, which is, V-Ray is a biased renderer. May all your rays render.
Yeah.
But here is the ultimate unbiased renderer.
Okay.
Sign off. Every ray is sacred.
Yes.
Kind of like, you know, every sperm is sacred from the meaning of life.
There you go. Until you eat the wafer.
Yeah. Until you get the wafer. Yeah. So yes. Okay. So something with rays is right.
Yeah.
We need to do something with rays.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why don't you start a competition on the podcast and see what people come up with?
Like
keyword rays.
A good sign off, but it involves rays, not buckets.
Right. Exactly. Forget buckets.
Because the reason buckets dropping made sense is because, you know, that's the last thing that you wait for on a render. And then that's the end of the render and the end of the podcast.
And who did the theme song again?
His name is Brady Harris.
Okay.
So he was, remember I was talking about 9/11?
Yeah.
He was my neighbor, lived across the hall from us.
Oh, okay.
So we had a fourplex. When we first moved to LA, we had a fourplex and down in Venice. And, you know, it's all kind of, you know, it's LA, so everything's kind of outdoor. But we just, like, walked out our door into their door. And so they were across there from us. And Brady was a musician, or is a musician. He has a band, and he's a lot of fun. And then he started doing a lot of stuff on the ukulele.
Yeah.
I thought
it was. Did you give him the lyrics?
If you go to episode 1 or 2, it's with Brady where Daniel Buck and I are trying to figure out, like, literally it's us trying to figure out the song.
Okay.
And so we are explaining lyrics or concepts or terms that are used in rendering.
Yeah.
And he has no idea what any of this is, but
right.
he's saying, okay, well, this is cool.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this would rhyme. Like, we used, like, subsurface scattering. It's like, oh, that's going to be great. But we never actually used it. But it's we just gave him terms, and he came up with some lyrics, and then Daniel and I tweaked them.
Something about global illumination won't lead you astray or something. Yeah, yeah.
Well, because, like, I'm a big person that back at DD on Day After Tomorrow, I hated the fact that people were using the term ambient occlusion as...
Right. It won't lead you astray.
Yeah. Ambient occlusion is passé.
Oh, right.
And that global illumination will not lead you astray.
Okay.
So, but people would use ambient occlusion as their version of global illumination, which is like, that's not global illumination. That's ambient occlusion.
Right.
It's a different thing.
Yeah.
So anyway. So, okay. Yeah. So yeah, we came up with these things. And
We'll come up with a campaign.
Okay.
You know, elicit responses from your listener base and see, you know, do a competition. That'd be cool. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do that. Well, that's not a bad idea. Because I've been thinking about it. It's like we do kind of need a sign off.
Yeah.
You're right. You know, enjoy your burrito. It's good. Mm-hmm. You know, by the way, did you know that Nerdist is no longer Nerdist?
It's like ID10T.
ID10T,
yeah.
Yeah, which is idiot.
Right.
That's what it stands for.
Well, I remember when they came into Bad Robot doing an interview. Yeah, it was
fun.
Yeah.
Chris Hardwick?
Yeah. He came in there,
right. You talked to JJ, right? Yeah.
I'm sure he'll do it again because now JJ's directing episode 9 and all that.
Right.
But yeah, come up with some kind of a closing.
You may be able to help me with this. I don't know if you can really.
I'm going to try to set you up with some key interviews.
Yeah. Chris Hardwick.
Chris Hardwick. You know, you should interview him.
That's what I want to interview him about. Because he's actually been one of those guys in the popular press or popular, you know, culture or whatever. I don't want to call press, but like what I do, culture, that has kind of put down CG a lot in his podcast.
Yeah, you got to talk with him.
And and as a nerd,
yeah,
that's BS.
Well, he interviews a lot of actors, right? And their knowledge base on the post-production process.
Well, I think he needs
some of them are not as...
Well, if he's going to be the nerdist, which he's not anymore, but it's still technically he's a nerd, right? Mm-hmm. He needs to appreciate nerd culture that includes computer graphics.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And all the people that do computer graphics are talented and contribute an enormous amount. It's not just pressing F5 on a keyboard and making a render.
Yeah. You
know? So that's usually just a refresh. But nonetheless, you know what I mean? It's just there's more to it than that. And I think that Chris should realize that when people say they don't like CG, it's not that they don't like CG. They just don't like bad CG.
Right.
Good CG, you can't tell. And that's the curse.
Good CG, you generally cannot even tell it's there.
Right. Which is the curse of good CG.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You don't know the effort that was put into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, let's end on that.
Okay.
You don't know the effort that was put into it.
Yeah, you don't know it.
Yeah. Or the veracity of the renderer.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, Ken, this has been fantastic. I love hanging out with you. Great to hang out.
Likewise. Great to see you after so much time. Cheers. Yeah. At least this probably hasn't gone on quite as long as a Dan Thrawn interview.
Not quite, but it's a good one.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Signing out.